central bank digital currencies, digital IDs, artificial intelligence, and big tech surveillance. What does our digital future really look like? Join me, Alastair Harding, for a look into our digital future every Wednesday on Paul Brennan's Breakfast Show, right here on Reality Check Radio. Welcome to another edition of Our Digital Future on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alastair Harding, and over the past few weeks, we've been talking about the story of the digitization of our world. It's a story that was precipitated by our Reserve Bank's development of a New Zealand Central Bank Digital Currency, or CBDC, and the digital ID laws that are being put in place here in New Zealand around that. And we've been exploring what all of those things mean for our future. Included in that, we've heard from Dr. Robert Epstein, who told us about his research on how mega corporations like Google surveil us and manipulate us with digital technology. And we've also heard from renowned investment banker Catherine Austin Fitz about how CBDCs, in the central banker's own words, will be used to control and manipulate us as well. And just last week, we also heard from author, entrepreneur, and investor Aaron Day about the added digitization or tokenization of our assets and who's driving these changes to our future on a global scale. And if you want to hear those interviews, you'll find them in the replays section of the Reality Check Radio app and website. Just do a search for Our Digital Future. And if you do that, through it all, you'll hear the message coming through loud and clear. This is about two words beginning with the letter C, centralized control. But it's not enough to simply assert these things are happening. We also have to understand where it has come from. And so today I have an interview with G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, the incredible book which details what he calls the most blatant scam in history, the founding of the US Federal Reserve. And in this interview, you'll hear from Ed how the creation of the Federal Reserve is central to the story of our digital future, and also how the creation of money is controlled by another C word, a cartel, and how it has led us to the brink of collectivism. This is probably the most enlightening interview we've had so far on our digital future because it draws on his research of the Federal Reserve to give us a view of how the building blocks of dystopia were put in place, then reflects on it all in the context of his famous 1984 interview with former KGB agent Yuri Bezmenov, in which the stages of ideological subversion were outlined, which today we see happening before us. But mostly what he says pulls back the facade that shrouds the true nature of the system we live in, and in the shadow of that realization, he challenges us to think on what we truly want our world to be. So, G. Edward Griffin, Ed, thank you for joining us on Reality Check Radio for Our Digital Future. It's a real honor to have you here.
Well, thanks for inviting me. As we were saying just before we went on the air, this is what I do nowadays, and I'm glad to be able to share my ideas and my information. So thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so our digital future has arisen from the discussion about the development of CBDCs, and in particular, the development of our own New Zealand CBDC. And today I'd like to talk about the bigger picture of where all this came from in the beginning. But to understand that, we need to understand the creation of central banks. And that history is pretty much the history of the Federal Reserve as much as anything. And there's no better history of that than your famous book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. So to ease us into this rather large topic, let's start with the title. What's The Creature from Jekyll Island?
Well, as the title of my book, I was trying to convey a couple of things all at the same time. I was trying to create something that was historically accurate, so that had some meaning, even though it wasn't immediately apparent. You had to read a little bit before you understand the meaning. And the other reason was I wanted to make it sound intriguing. But the title really does have historical meaning because, of course, the book is about the Federal Reserve System. And that system was created on Jekyll Island. It's a real island. It's off the coast of Georgia. And it was on that island back in 1910 that the six, probably the most powerful financial banking systems in America and big banks in Europe met on that island in a highly secret meeting. on the island at that time was privately owned by these wealthy financiers and industrialists in America. Primarily, it was a place where people on the East Coast would go in the wintertime when New York and Chicago and places like that would freeze up. They would jump in their train car or drive to Georgia, where the temperature was a little more amicable, and they would get off in New Brunswick, and then they would take a ferry boat across the inland straits to the island. And once you got on the island, you were pretty private. Had a beautiful clubhouse. It's still there. And this is where they went, where they would be away from the prying eyes of reporters. And this, they wanted to do this thing in secret. And when I was studying this thing for the first time, it struck me funny that forming what we now call the Federal Reserve System was in those days of such a nature that it had to be done in secret. Why? Wouldn't these guys be proud of what they were doing? Wouldn't they be boasting to the world that they were creating something that was really great and going to solve some problems? Why the secrecy? So that aroused my curiosity. And of course, as I dug into it, I found out why. I found out that when people do things in secret, it's usually because they have something to hide. And I found out after a while what it was that they were trying to hide and did indeed successfully do so. So I thought all of this was kind of intriguing. It had drama to it. So I decided to give that title to the book. And I'm glad I did, because it's a memorable title and people have no trouble recognizing it as connected to the Federal Reserve System.
So the creature is the Federal Reserve?
Yes.
What did they invent on that island in those secret meetings?
Well, they didn't really invent anything, but they built something that was commonly known around the world, and it's called a cartel. Cartels were not invented on Jekyll Island, but the banking cartel was. This was at the turn of the last century, and the world was becoming cartelized radically and rapidly at that time. And it was time, I guess, they figured, to take the competing banks, the most powerful institutions in the world, financially powerful anyway, and that translates into other kinds of power pretty soon. And they decided that instead of competing with each other anymore, they were competing, you know, from Paris and London and New York and for control of the financial markets. They were really fighting each other. They were serious competitors. And they decided that that's not the way to go. They saw how successfully the railroad cartel was being built, and they said, well, you know, we should do this. So that was the secrecy. What they did is they built something they wanted the public to believe was an agency of the federal government, because the people, even then, not as much as now, but even then, they had this sort of admiration for government, this, oh, if the government is doing it, it's good. And they had pretty well swallowed the idea that you know, somebody comes up and knocks on your door and he says, hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. They believed it in those days. Well, anyway, that's what they created then was, in short answer to your question, was a banking cartel. And they did it in such a way as to make it look like, well, that it was an agency of the federal government of the United States.
So what is it that they actually do? I mean, the official line is that they fix monetary policy and they issue money. And if you ask most people, they'd probably say that they have this big vault of gold, which is the value that backs the US currency. But that's not the case, is it? What is it that they actually do?
Well, what does any cartel do? That's really the question. If we understand that a cartel is a combination or coordinated organization mutually operated by independent business enterprises that normally would be in competition with each other. They're all in the same industry. And rather than compete with each other, they go together and start creating cartel agreements that would reduce the need for competition. For example, the first thing that comes to mind is they all get together and agree on prices for their products. So now, no matter what bank you go to, you're going to get about the same interest rates on your deposit. There's no competition anymore. And the terms of the loan, all of the terms of financial transactions begin to look exactly the same from one bank to the other. And so that the only reason you have for going to one bank over the other is because it's closer to you. There's very little difference between banks anymore because they're part of a cartel. So it's what was happening all around the world. And it's a very good business model for the organizations that do it, but it's a very bad business model for the public, because now they're going to have to accept goods or services either at a higher price or a lower quality and less choice. So that's what they created. They created a cartel, the banking cartel. They sold it to the American people as an agency of the federal government. And now that's shocking enough, but it gets really scary when you realize how they implemented it. Because they intended really just to be approved to have a cartel and operate openly without violating laws, because there were some laws that prevent organizations from avoiding competition, antitrust laws and that kind of thing. So they wanted to legalize this thing that they were doing, but they never dreamed that so quickly. In the long run, they planned to do it, but they never dreamed that coming right out of the chute, that they'd be able to get the politicians so stupidly ignorant about the whole process that they would turn over to this cartel the function and privilege of creating the nation's money supply. That was really, it was a shock to them, because they thought there would be a lot of resistance to it. But primarily because of ignorance, I think, on the part of most politicians, as they had no idea how this monetary system works. They're easily fooled. They were easily impressed by the amounts of money that were being thrown at them to do the right thing. After all, these bankers, even in those days, they were creating money out of paper. It's hard for people who've been born into the present system to realize that prior to this period of 1910, it was considered that good money was backed by something of real tangible interest or useful, you know, like gold or silver. That's what it usually was. However, you could go to a bank and take out a loan on your car or your house or your farm. Well, in essence, even though the bank created that money out of nothing, which they did, they insisted that you put up your car or your house or your farm as collateral. Now, you were tricked into that because you didn't have to do that. All of a sudden, you thought you were borrowing money that existed, that somebody had somehow magically created, and you were lucky enough to borrow it at interest. But what they didn't tell you is that, no, they didn't have any money. But you put up this collateral note. You agreed that they could take your farm or your tractor or whatever if you refused or declined to pay or could not pay. So you created the collateral. So the money, you created the money yourself, and they were charging you interest on it. This is how tricky it is. And the average guy on the street had no idea about how fraudulent this system is, because like most of us, we were, as a boy, I was raised thinking that, banks, they're the most reliable, dependable, honest organizations you could possibly be. Look, they got vaults and guards and everything, and they're so careful about examining your record before they loan anything to you. Oh, you could trust these people. Little did I realize that it's probably one of the two most corrupt institutions in the world.
Okay, so maybe to understand all of that, maybe we should actually talk about what money is. And I know that might sound a little bit silly to say, but the answer's not that simple, is it? What is money?
Yes. Well, that's of course a critical part of the whole story. You must realize that I was probably one of the least qualified people to write a book of this kind. I never dreamed how complicated and filled with fraud and deception the field was. So once I decided to go down that path, then I really became a student. So I had to really struggle with that. And I found out that a lot of people who were professionals in the field argued among themselves as to what money is. I got a hold of an international transcript of one of the international meetings back in 1950s or something I think it was held in Geneva, and all the heads of state, all the heads of the financial divisions of these major countries of the world were meeting there, and they spent half their time arguing about what is money. They still argue over it. And yet there's no room for argument if you understand the principle. So let's get to the chase. I squeezed out of all of this a pretty clear and simple path, that money is defined in almost all of the dictionaries as a medium of exchange. That's it. That's what money is. It's a medium of exchange, economic exchange. Now, it's not exchange. A direct exchange would be barter. I have two apples, you have two oranges. I'll exchange one of my apples for one of your oranges. That's not money. That was a barter exchange. So money is, you accept, it means it's something you accept, even though you have no use for it itself. You accept it because you know you can exchange it for something that you do want. It's something that is readily acceptable by almost everybody, so it's easy to market, it's easy to swap out. And it takes time in a civilization to discover what is the medium of exchange that the people in that culture or that civilization have agreed upon. It takes a long time, trial and error. Mm. And the first metals that were used as money was iron, because they used iron to make swords and shields, and that was essential to survive. So if you were a steel maker and you could make steel swords or shields, you had no trouble swapping iron or steel as money, very much in demand. But after a while, everybody could make steel, and it was not that difficult. So gradually the preference shifted to something which was more rare, and of course that's silver or gold. It turned out that the people that had excess quantities or large quantities of gold or silver naturally had to worry about what are they going to do with it? How do they protect it? People find out that they've got all this stuff somewhere in their house. So people who had a lot of gold and silver had to hire guards 24 hours a day. So it evolved in time that people who weren't in the business went to the goldsmiths and said, look, you've got the vault and the guards, can I pay you to guard my supply of gold and silver, and just keep it for me so that I don't have to worry about protecting it? Of course, that was a good deal, and that's how banking started. You deposited your gold or silver into the bank, into the goldsmith's vault, and he would guard it, and when you gave him your gold or your silver, by this time paper had been developed, and you were given a receipt. The idea was, now don't lose this receipt, because this says that you are entitled to 1 or 7 or 22 ounces of gold, 0.999 pure, on demand. And so, okay, that's how receipt money started. That's how paper money started. And that's how our nation was built, is on money which was as good as gold, had gold backing behind it. But the final stage in this process is what they call fractional reserve money. And that's where the bankers started to get smart. They were getting all this gold put into their vaults, and they would get a reasonable fee for storing the gold and guarding it. But the goldsmith decided, why don't we lend it out and charge interest on it? And he starts loaning out this gold that is not his to loan. So he's loaning out 97% of the gold and collecting good interest on it, and everything is working fine, and the bankers are really getting fabulously rich by loaning out other people's money and collecting interest that should be going to those other people. But they don't tell the other people that it's not a demand deposit, it's a time deposit. This is how banking was born, in this kind of trickery. And then finally the day comes when the word goes out, they don't have our gold. Now there's a big lineup, people start breaking windows, start threatening the people working inside, and you've got the classic bank run, and the banks go belly up, and that's the story of money. It went from good money gradually to not so good money, finally to not money at all, but just a mechanism for plunder.
So this has grown and changed over the years a lot, hasn't it? So I guess then my question is to you, who are they today? I'm guessing that they have grown a lot bigger than the five or six families who met on Jekyll Island and devised the Federal Reserve, as you describe in your book. They now reach around the world, don't they? So who are they today?
Well, that's a good question, because it's always that has always been shrouded in a certain amount of mystery, because they don't want their private names known. But some are so obviously involved that they can't help it, even in spite of all their efforts. The first banking dynasty of history that really reached megalithic proportions would be the Rothschilds. They're the ones that really pioneered this whole thing and brought it to fruition in England. And of course, they became the dominant banking institution behind the Bank of England. And really, it's the Rothschild Bank is what it really is. And that's, of course, one of the elements of these central banks. They partner with governments, but if you look closely enough, you always find that the real banking side of that partnership is in private hands, which, by the way, is the definition of fascism, is the combination of government and industry. But that's another story. It's money created out of nothing. The people who are operating the system usually do very well, and the good old boys that go along with it and help just want to be team players, they can make out pretty well for a while, but eventually they lose. So that's the story of money.
So if I could get this straight, what I think you've explained it very well, and I think I understand it now. The reason you call it a cartel is because they've just monopolized the production of money, and they don't actually have any value to back it up. They've just monopolized it and said they're the only ones that can do it, and everyone else is locked out. Is that right?
That's it, exactly. And the magic word in all of that is the word monopoly. This system doesn't work unless you've got the power of the state to force everyone to accept this thing called money. Because eventually you get to the point where nobody would accept it in their right mind. But there are laws written that require you to accept it. So that's what keeps it afloat.
Okay, so that brings me to the CBDC situation. All over the world right now, central banks in almost every country are developing CBDCs. Is this perhaps an admission in a way that the fiat system that they created has been found out and is failing, and they need to start again? Is that what's going on?
If I were a college professor, I'd give half credit to that answer. Yes, they're running it into the ground. There's no doubt about that. But starting all over again is the part that I would question. They have something that, in their minds at least, is even better. It's not starting over again, but replacing the old system with a new and better system that's even worse than the old one, if you can imagine that.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I got a half credit for that. That's not bad.
That's not bad.
Okay. You say they think a CBDC is going to be better. Why will it be better?
It won't be better. That's a lie. There's no reason that it'll be better. For them, maybe. For the banking cartel, yeah. Because it's no longer money for these people. When they formed the Federal Reserve System, it was my impression by reading their private papers and their speeches in Congress and their letters, all this stuff, that their primary motive was money. They wanted to just legally plunder the people. And they knew that the present laws would not allow it, so they had to rewrite the financial system legally, and that's why they had the Federal Reserve System and the charter and all of that, to make it legal. I don't think that anybody had dreamed, except maybe a couple of people in their wildest imaginations, that they would become rulers of the universe over the people, like the pharaohs of Egypt, you know. I don't think that was there. But by the time it reached their grandchildren, and these people in the middle had already acquired such wealth that they already had all the money that you could possibly spend, they already had too many yachts, too many summer homes, and now they were spending money on buying loyalty from corporations and other governments. And the current generation of these people who are holding those positions, right now, I don't think they really care so much about money, because when you think about it, what is money good for? The only value it is to measure the amount of claim you have on other people's efforts, on their work or their loyalty, their services, Now, the digital currency that's coming doesn't even exist. You cannot put it in a coffee can. You cannot put it in your wallet. You can't do anything with it until they allow you to do it through the technology of their computer systems. And they track everything. And that includes what you spend it for and how much you get, how stiff your taxes are. They'll take the taxes right out of your account for you. You won't have to pay any more taxes. They'll just take it. And they'll take it in accordance with your ability to obey their orders.
It's the ultimate control device for them, isn't it? Because
yes,
they can tell you how much their product is worth, and they can even tell you what other people's products are worth, right? Like, they could tell you how much a bottle of milk is worth and program that into the money, couldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And they brag about that. They say they're gonna level out the economy with measures like that. But don't forget, they also have then the power to say, well, you don't get any milk. We looked at your health records, and we think you have a condition that milk is bad for you. Or more likely, they'll say, well, other people need milk more than you, and we decide you don't need milk, so you cannot buy milk. Or they may even go further and say, we don't like you. You said something bad about us, and you don't get any money at all. You can't buy milk or toilet paper. I don't care what it is. You're out, buddy. You're dead. And this is what we're coming to. So now this is where it's changed. It's no longer about money. So when you have the ability to control the so-called money, to that extent, it's no longer money. It's just a means of control. So who needs money when you can control everybody's actions that way? Money is even not necessary anymore in the sense that it belongs to the individual. Now it's strictly a measurement of control.
When you say that, I just think of the words, you'll own nothing but be happy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You'll be happy as long as you do exactly what we say and agree to smile a lot. So that's why it must be stopped. I'd like to just, on that theme before we pass over it, if I may, there's a great documentary film produced by the BBC, and it was the story of George Orwell. And he wrote 1984, and it was a very grim story and all that. And the actor was so good, I couldn't hardly believe that that wasn't really George Orwell. Now, having said that, we fast forward to the end of the story. He dies of tuberculosis, and there's a BBC newspaper reporter in the room trying to capture a last short interview with him before he dies, I guess. He's sitting there propped up in his bed, gasping, and she's sitting at the foot of the bed, and she says, well, Mr. Orwell, in your book, you've created a very grim picture for the future. All of humanity will be living under a military boot crashing into the face of a human being. What can we do to prevent that? And he looks at her, he gasps, and he says, well, there's only one thing we can do, and that is don't let it happen. And it struck me like a bolt of lightning, because everybody's figuring, how can I avoid this? You know, what can I do? Well, shall I get out of debt? Shall I buy gold and silver? Shall I get ammunition and guns? Or what should I do? You know, you can do all those things and probably should do most of them. But if we don't stop it from happening, it won't make any difference, at least not to us. It might somewhere down the line, the future generation.
Yes, and I remember there's a passage in 1984 about that, when the main character, Winston Smith, is remembering back to the early days when Big Brother was taking control and they were hiding in the subway, and he saw this old man who just was sitting there inconsolable, saying, why did we trust them? Why did we trust them over and over again? And I suppose in a way that segues to the next point, the next question that I wanted to ask you, which is all about your famous interview with Yuri Bezmenov, which, to explain to our viewers, Yuri Bezmenov was a former KGB agent. And you talked all about communism infiltrating the United States and the West in general. Is that what perhaps this is? Is this what we're seeing? This control state is just communism or Marxism taking control of us?
Absolutely. I think it's self-evident. Just look at what's going on. I think it's important in any discussion of this sort of thing to recognize that the word communist needs to be examined, and the word socialist, and all those words need to be re-examined. What's the difference between communism, socialism, fascism, Nazism? You know, what's the difference between a conservative and a liberal? Really, can you define it? What about left wing, right wing? Is there any other option? If you don't like communism, does that mean you have to be a fascist? Is that the only option? All of these things have to be examined. And I came to the conclusion quite a while ago that most of those words need to be thrown out. There are only two words, as I see it, that mean anything in the Western world in terms of political ideology. And that is a conflict between collectivism on the one side and individualism on the other side. Those are two words that are kind of foreign to the ear to most people today, but in reading some of these books that go back 100 years, they were very commonly used and commonly understood by most people. But those words were expunged starting in World War I, and by the end of World War II, they were completely unknown and gotten rid of. I have come to the conclusion a long time ago that the conflict between individualism and collectivism is the issue behind all other issues. I mean, all of them, political issues, if you know what the difference is between them. And so I think that a lot of the time we get divided among ourselves because we're using the wrong words to describe ideas which are either supposed to have a sense of goodness or badness to them, but we don't know why, except we don't like them. And so anyway, having said that, when I met with Yuri Bezmenov, that was in a day before I'd come to this realization, and I was still thinking in terms of left versus right, and I think he was too. So we were speaking of communism doing this, and there's no question about it that we have out and out Communist Party people involved in this attempt to destroy the American culture and political system, and they're proud of it. They speak of it. They boast of it. So we know that, yeah, the communists are there, but what are the communists? Let's talk about the deep state now. If we realize what this deep state is no different than communists. It's just that it's a different word. It's collectivism. And with a little flair of the deep state is a bunch of collectivists who have specialized in penetrating into positions of government. Other than that, it's no different than any other form of collectivist. So having said all of that, yes, the things that Yuri Bezmenov was talking about, if we use the word collectivism, applies 100% across the board. And not all of it's being done by people who have a loyalty to communism. Some of them have a loyalty to who knows what else. Maybe it's just a political party loyalty. Maybe they feel that their loyalty is to the Democrat Party or something, or who knows, maybe to the Republican Party. They don't know what those things mean. Nobody can define what Republicans or Democrats stand for. They change their principles every election, depending on public opinion. They're trying to please the masses rather than stand for something that's firm forever. No, none of that. So back to the question. When I was speaking with Yuri, he and I were both visualizing at that time a combat between America as we then knew it and communism coming from the Soviet Union. And he was right, and I was right, and it is still correct. But now we know that it's not just the Soviet Union. Collectivism is bigger than Russia versus America or China. It has no nationality. Collectivism can be anywhere. It can be in the White House, it can be Republican, it can be Democrat. In fact, some of our worst collectivists are Republicans. They speak a great line, collectivists, you know. And so I don't know why I'm going into such detail on that. It's because I urge anybody who wants to know where we're headed to think about the fact that the words collectivism and individualism are the words we should focus on and not communism, because that's not it. Communism could be wiped out. In fact, it might be. It could be part of the plan to have some great leader on the white horse who represents the opposite of communism. But he could still be a collectivist, you see. But we elect him to office or something. Oh, we elected an anti-communist. He's a collectivist, by the way, but he hates the communists and the socialists, and he gives good speeches and so forth. And now we got all this violence, and now we need martial law. So now we have our hero, who's supposedly our people, declaring martial law to put down all this left-wing communist violence, and they get what the collectivists get what they want. It's martial law, but done by our man instead of somebody we hate. And you got to be thinking of these things. Fake opposition is our enemy's strongest weapon today. And we're not going to overcome that unless we understand this conflict between individualism and collectivism and identify it for really what it is. As a matter of fact, I produced a booklet on that. So if anybody wants to see what's going on in my mind on this topic of individualism versus collectivism, you can get a free copy download. What you type in is chasm, C-H-A-S-M, .realityzone.com. That's chasm.realityzone.com. And you can download a copy of this thing called The Chasm.
A lot of what we're seeing just seems to be accepted by most people. And it feels like we're sleepwalking into this digital dystopia. And it does seem like people are just programmed to accept it. Like, I remember during COVID, it was baffling to me how people just went along with it without examining what was right in front of them. Did Yuri Bezmenov give you any ideas about how this programming could be deprogrammed? Because it feels like it's not just our money being programmed here.
No, he did not. He had no idea. In fact, most of us have no idea. Without having access to the great amounts of money that our enemy does, I mean, they have all the money. They make the bloody stuff. They can make it out of nothing. But we'd all agree that whatever it is, it will happen naturally only if about 3% of the population really understand what's going on. Now, that sounds like maybe a ridiculous number, but allow me to explain. History has always been written by about 3% of the population. They're the movers and shakers. And the way I see it, these are just my numbers, it seems like all the great movements of history, the development of the new political system, certainly the development of the American constitutional system, where the American Revolution was fought by a minority, a very small minority, and all of that. It seems to me that in every one of these episodes, you start with 1% of the population, which is the thought leaders. They're the visionaries. And they'll do something which will attract the 3%, the movers and shakers. They may not be the originators of the idea, but they're the ones that are really motivated. And they will attract around them the leaders of the 15%, which would be the ones that really are mobilized to make things happen. 15% will shift the whole course of history. At the other end of the spectrum, there usually is another 15% pulling in the opposite direction. And in between, you've got 70% of the people who have no idea what the heck is going on in the first place, couldn't care less, have no instinct for becoming involved in it, and they're just waiting to see who wins. And they'll say, oh, I've always been on that side. It's been true, certainly in the American Revolution. A lot of the colonists went back to England, or they went to Canada, just so they wouldn't have to choose up sides. They were afraid they'd be on the wrong side. And so having said that, then, Yuri and I talked a little bit about that, but we know that what we have, we've already got the 1%. I think we've got the 3% for sure. And we're very close. We're not organized. We don't know all these people. We have been pretty much denied the means of communication and organization, so that if all these 15% who I'm sure are out there would suddenly discover that they're not alone, actually, and work together in a common cause with a common strategy, it would be like a cakewalk. So my whole mission in what's left of my life is to try and get that 15% to wake up and meet each other face to face, get organized, start to do something. And out of that will come the solution, which frankly, I don't know what it is, but it has to start with that 15%. And if we get that, the rest will fall into place.
Okay, so we've gone a little bit over time, so I don't want to take too much more of your time up, but I do want to ask you one last question, or perhaps just explore that point one last way. And that's that recently I was listening to a podcast where Neil Howe was being interviewed, and Neil is one of the authors of the Fourth Turning book. And if our listeners don't know about that book, briefly, it's about how history goes through four 20-year stages every 80 years. And the last stage is the stage of destruction. And then we have a stage of rebirth, and the concept of cycles just keeps going throughout history. And it's been noted throughout history, these 80-year cycles of four 20-year periods. Anyway, what Neil Howe was saying was that the fourth turning, the destruction phase, which many people believe that we're going through right now, is always punctuated by a loss of community. And we see that with all the division that's going on. You know, like Black Lives Matter is dividing us by race, and Me Too divides us by gender, and COVID divided us by vaccine status and all of that. And as we turn into the Enlightenment period of rebirth, there will be a rediscovery of community. And I quite like the way he said that, because the way out of these systems of control that we've been talking about today, if community is the answer, then we're not all sitting around waiting for some hero to come and save us on a white horse, or Will Smith to turn up with a theme song and save us all, or something like that. It's actually about us all coming together, about humanity learning to be together again. Do you have any thoughts on that? Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with it, and I do have some thoughts on it. I think it's absolutely correct. A community is essential, and it's been denied to us because they've tricked us into choosing up sides on so many sub-issues that are not even real. So there's no question about that. But the community alone is not enough, because I've seen a lot of movements spring up and say, let's just get together. We're the good guys and they're the bad guys. So let's get going. You know, send in some money, let's an organization, let's have a place to meet. And they all get together, and then they say, well, what are we going to do? What do we believe in? Do we have any principles? No, we're just the good guys. Well, that's doomed to failure. Because first of all, they'll argue amongst each other as to what it is they really do hold in common. And secondly, there will be infiltrators, there will be fake leaders that'll go into their groups and say all the right things, maybe come up with some money and be hard workers. And there'll be fake leaders, and they'll take over the organization. And I've seen it happen. So yes, community is important, but don't forget, you have to know what you believe in. It's not enough to know what you don't want. You have to know what you want. And that's not so easy, because it's not taught in school. You have to figure it out for yourself, or read it in some of those books. That's the main purpose of the chasm. When you read the Creed of Freedom, that is a statement, a very simple statement of what we believe in. And that's the thing that binds us together in that community. So yes, we need the community, but we need that idea, the ideology that'll hold us together and keep us on track against our enemies.
Ed, thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely incredible to sit down and talk with you, and it's been an incredible conversation. And I'm just so glad we got to put it on record. So thank you so much for your time, and thanks also for all of your amazing work over the years for all of us.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. Thank you for inviting me. I've been to New Zealand only once, and I really enjoyed it. I love the people there. I love all those hills, all the sheep, and all the beauty that was there. Good people. I didn't like the politicians so well, but the people I thought were magnificent. So don't let it happen to New Zealand.
That's G. Edward Griffin, the renowned author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, the incredible book which details what he calls the most blatant scam in history, the founding of the US Federal Reserve, here to help explain the bigger picture of our digital future. And I do wholeheartedly recommend, if you want to hear more from Ed, that you visit his website at realityzone.com. That's realityzone, one word, .com. The story he tells is of how our money system is built on a foundation of secrecy that belies its image of trust and integrity. And just the fact that economists all over the world today still argue over what money is and how it is created is proof enough that the true nature of the system is largely unknown. And what Ed has told us today in this interview is the bigger picture of the story that we're experiencing today in the digital age, but he saw it 70 years ago. as to what will happen in another 70 years, perhaps it's his final comments that quote George Orwell that ring in my ears, that none of the dystopia that he foresees can happen if we don't let it happen. My name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to my interview with G. Edward Griffin on Our Digital Future, only on Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.